And a man who has written a terrific book. He's a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. Manhattan Institute is a sort of a self-contradictory statement. It is located in Manhattan, and the people do think clearly. I don't understand them, but I admire them. Let me put it that way. It seems to me to be to enter the world of cognitive dissonance on steroids, but they're terrific. The folks that I've had on from the Manhattan Institute, I have to say, have been great. Robert Bryce is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, and he is the author of a new book, Smaller, Faster, Lighter, Denser, Cheaper, or if you will, SFLDC. The subtitle is How Innovation Keeps Proving the Catastrophists Wrong. And bless you, sir. It's terrific. And welcome to the Dennis Prager Show.
Well, thank you, Dennis. Very, very kind of you to say that. Thank you.
I got to ask you, as I do the other Manhattan Institute people, then, of course, I want to talk about your thesis, which is so important. Do you live in Manhattan?
I live in Austin, Texas. So I'm many of the...
Oh, that's the same thing. You know, that's... Come on. You crack me up. Well, do you have a masochistic tendency at the Manhattan Institute? I can't believe it. The guy leaves
Madison,
Manhattan...
I could have said Madison, Wisconsin, or Boulder, Colorado, or...
Yeah, you're right. You could have, and I would have said the same thing. Exactly.
No, I have a great gig, Dennis. Most of the people who are affiliated with Manhattan Institute, the fellows, the other people who work on health care and pensions and other things, live in New York, and I've been living in Austin now for nearly 30 years, and I signed on with them about 4 years ago, and they said, you know, we're happy for you to stay in Austin. So I'm very happy that they said that.
It is funny, though, that that's your alternative. Okay, anyway, at least you're in Texas, so the state somewhat bails you out. This is a very important book, and you've got essentially two overriding theses. Is that fair to say in the book?
I think so, and I can lay them out, or you can explain what. Tell me.
Yeah,
what
you do it. You do it. You wrote it.
Sure. Well, the book fundamentally shows how innovation is making things better. It's a rebuke to the catastrophists. It's a rebuttal to the neo-Malthusians. We've heard for decades, even centuries now, that we're headed for disaster, whether it's food shortages or peak oil or peak natural gas, or we've even seen books called Peak Everything, and that we're headed for disaster because we've embraced technology, because we're using too much, we're driving too much, we're flying too much, whatever. The reality is more people today are living longer, freer, healthier lives than at any time in human history. So the book is an optimistic one. I'm not saying everything is going to be great. It's not. We see that from Damascus to Donetsk today. You know, we have a lot of problems. But the trend, the inexorable trend, is toward liberty, toward economic freedom, and toward higher living standards.
Well, I'm not sure I agree on the liberty part, because that's not a technological issue. It's a moral issue. But it doesn't matter. Your point is so important. You really take on what you call the catastrophists. I generally don't engage in what are the motives of X or Y. I'm more interested in their positions and their behavior. But I am curious, why do two people, neighbors, one wakes up and has no particular concern. They're both equally moral people. They both care about the world. One wakes up every day and is just panicked over the thought that there will be too many people in the world and they will eat up the world's resources. The other one says, like you, you know what? We've met these challenges constantly and we'll do fine thanks to technology. Why is one so afraid and why the other so optimistic?
You know, that's a great question, Dennis, and I wish I had a glib answer to provide for you. I don't. I worked for a guy a while back, and he said something one day that made me laugh, but I thought it was actually fairly profound, and I've thought about it many times since then. He said, you know, some people aren't happy unless they're scared to death. You know, they're just not happy unless they're worried.
That's fascinating. That may be good for one of my happiness hours. We're going to continue. This is really good stuff. Robert Bryce, Senior Fellow, Manhattan Institute. New book, Smaller, faster, lighter, denser, cheaper. How innovation keeps proving the catastrophists wrong. We'll be back in a moment. Hi, everybody. Dennis Prager here. I am totally on board with this man that technology will solve so many of the technology. It doesn't solve moral problems. It helps on moral problems, and it creates moral problems, right? Nuclear energy is fantastic, and we also have nuclear bombs. Nuclear bombs can actually, on occasion, be used morally, but that's another subject. Rarely, but it is possible. As it was, I believe, in World War II. In any event, Robert Bryce is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, a great place. His new book is Smaller. Faster, lighter, denser, cheaper. How innovation keeps proving the catastrophists wrong. His original title was Smaller, Faster, Lighter, Denser, Cheaper, Finer, Better, Conciser. But his publisher said we are limiting the title to five adjectives. I called them up. I was curious about that.
You know, I went back and forth on the title trying to figure out, you know, people say it's a long title, and I look back, my last book is called Power Hungry, The Myths of Green Energy and the Real Fuels of the Future. This title, the new book, is actually the title is actually a couple of words shorter than the old one, but it just sounds longer.
Yes, it does, in fact. Now, I mean, to be perfectly honest, it does sound longer. The book is terrific. It is up at DennisPrager.com, and it's got a lot of good news. I won't say you are. What is your position on the following? Because the issue with global warming is, and I always remind my listeners, there are three things one has to believe, otherwise the issue is moot. One, that we humans are warming our planet in to an unprecedented degree. Two, that the warming is caused, well, that we are warming through carbon-based energy, and that this will lead to catastrophe. If it doesn't lead to catastrophe, then it doesn't matter if we're warming the planet. So do you accept the whole thesis or part of it?
Here's what I say. In the short answer I give, Dennis, is I'm an agnostic. Tell me, I'm a climate agnostic, resolutely so. And if that puts me in a tribe of one, then put me in a tribe of one.
No. That's honest. Go ahead.
So you know what it just disgusts me truly about any discussion these days we have about climate change and so on. It's primarily about which tribe are you on. Which are you, an Al Gore acolyte, or you work for big oil or big coal or some, you know, you believe we're headed for absolute ruin, or you say CO2 doesn't matter? Look, there's no question CO2 is a climate change. It's a greenhouse gas. That's well proven. What we don't know is the absolutely correct concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere. So to me, I want to move past this tribalism and discuss, okay, well, then what? If CO2 is bad, then what? What's the plan? In the book, I talk about what I believe are the best no-regrets policies moving forward, and that's why I'm so adamantly in favor of natural gas and nuclear. And so we are using a lot more natural gas in the U.S. The U.S. is leading the world in reducing its CO2 emissions. Okay, so bully for us. But the reality is, Dennis, since 1973, the fastest-growing form of energy on the planet is coal, and it continues to be the fastest-growing form of energy. So we can talk about CO2 and climate change and global warming until the cows come home, but as long as China, India, Indonesia, Vietnam, even Japan, Germany, Taiwan, these countries are building new coal-fired power plants at breakneck speed. So unless or until we get serious and we can find something that's cheaper than coal, we're not going to reduce CO2 emissions, not to any meaningful degree on a global basis.
There. So what would you like to see us?
So, longer answer than you wanted, I'm sure.
No. It was very good. Because it was clear. That's all I care about is clarity. So, but first of all, that was news to me. I did not know Germany is building coal mines or whatever the word would be.
Coal-fired power plants. Yeah.
Yeah, power plants. Yeah. Are they? Isn't Germany resolutely committed to green energy?
Absolutely, and it's ruining their economy. I mean,
I know. I've reported that. So how are they building coal-fired plants?
They don't have a choice. This is the great, by the way, or the it's not a paradox. I'm looking for the right word. It's the great oops moment for the Greens in Germany. They're anti-nuclear. Okay, so after Fukushima, they convinced the Merkel government to close down their nuclear power plants. Well, what are they doing now? They're building something on the order of 7 gigawatts, 7,000 megawatts of new coal-fired power plants. Their CO2 emissions
unbelievable.
Are
I did not know that. That's mind-blowing. By the way, how many people died? How many people died at Fukushima?
There were two.
Do you know?
Were directly attributable to the event,
uh-huh.
And they were.
I just want people to understand that.
Right.
There are more people killed by lightning.
There were workers
That's right.
who were trapped in the plants when the typhoon hit. They drown.
Yeah. So I want people. Oh, is that right? So it wasn't even from nuclear fallout.
Wasn't radiation. They were in the buildings and they were trapped and they drowned. So
terrible way to die.
Fukushima was a tremendous accident. It's going to be tremendously costly for Tokyo Electric.
Yeah, but it proves my point and yours about how safe nuclear power is.
Absolutely. And that's where, you know, it's interesting, and it's something I write about in Smaller Faster as well, Dennis, is it's interesting to me, fascinating, really, that in the wake of Fukushima, look what's happening in the nuclear sector. Now, we haven't seen a broad resurgence. We're not building, tremendous numbers of new reactors. That's clear. But look at investment dollars, how Bill Gates and Nathan Myhrvold are supporting a new company called TerraPower, looking at a new modular reactor design. Same with a company called Transatomic. There's a renaissance in people looking at nuclear who are serious about it. You know, many of them are diehard believers in climate change, which is fine with me, but they're looking again at nuclear because they realize it has to be part of our electric supply in the future.
Well, you wrote a terrific book here. I would like to have you on a more often basis because I would like to bounce technological issues off you.
Be happy.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
I would like that. You bet. Robert Bryce, the book is up at DennisPrager.com and it will cheer you. Hey folks, Dennis Prager here. We go to Marina Del Rey, California, and John. Hello, John. Dennis Prager.
Good morning, Mr. Prager. How are you? Thanks for
taking
my call. I am a conservative, religious American who has great faith in the power of individuals motivated by virtue to work voluntarily together. So I love what you say and do on the show, and I'm a staunch advocate and friend of Israel's. But I have a problem with the situation here, and that is that I don't feel like I'm well enough educated to defend Israel in these discussions I have with generally liberal people who blame Israel. I've never been to Israel, Allegations that I think are pure baloney. Can you educate me and maybe the rest of your audience who might be like me that, you know, what is life like for Arabs and Persians who happen to be Christian or Muslim in Israel?
It's so good for, it's so good for them that they don't leave. The freest Christians in the Middle East live in, as the Christians United for Israel, the 5,000 that I was with this here, that's why I'm in Washington and spoke to, testified to. As for Muslims, Arabs make up about a fifth. One out of five Israelis is an Arab, Muslim. And in almost every case, though there are Arab Christians too. And they have no desire to leave the Jewish state because that's the most free, prosperous place they can live. The amount of lies told about Israel is the greatest number of lies since the Nazis lied about Jews. And I very rarely use Nazi parallels. It is also the first time in history that people have sided with the police state against a free state in a war. There is no example of this since free countries were established, of people siding with the police state. The pre-medieval world of Hamas, the beheaders of Hamas, the theocratic torturers of Hamas, the people who have as their charter the annihilation of Israel, and you have morons in the West, truly, truly what they're called moral idiots who support Hamas against Israel. It's alternately, I don't know if it is intellectually or morally more confusing that people would think that way. It must emanate from something twisted in the individual because it is a twisted view. You are listening to The Dennis Prager Show. Hello, everybody. Dennis Prager here. Absolutely delighted to have Katie Pavlich on. Katie and I go back a long time with her. Whatever she has written, I think we've had her on her last book, and now she has a new one out. Of course, you know her. She's a Fox News contributor, news editor for townhall.com, and somehow or other survives living in Washington, D.C. Katie, it's great to have you on the show.
Great to be on, Dennis. Thanks so much for having me on.
The book is Assault and Flattery. By the way, I am a big devotee of good titles. No, titles are unbelievably important. Did you come up with that?
I did come up with that.
Your mother.
Brainstorming and run-throughs, that's what I came up with. So
very impressive.
Well, thank you. I think it's pretty appropriate.
It is.
What the definition of flattery is in terms of how Democrats treat women, I think it's pretty appropriate.
That's what it's about, folks, how the left treats women. The truth about the left and their war on women. So you have decided, which I think we should have done a long time ago, to tell the truth, and that is there isn't a war on women from the right but from the left. So make your case.
Well, I've noticed through my study of the left that they tend to accuse their opponents of exactly what they're doing just in a loud way. And when they're accusing the right of a war on women, it's really to distract away from decades of abuse towards women, whether it's literal sexual abuse and assault or whether it's bad government policies that shift economic opportunities away from women by making them more dependent on the government. Most recently, obviously, in the 2012 campaign, the war on women rhetoric from the left was one of the key selling points for Barack Obama. You know, no one else in, I'd say, American history has used the issue of defining women by the pills that they take more than Barack Obama did in 2012. But the fact is that it told a lot of lies in that campaign. They misrepresented the right in that campaign. And I think it was just about time to stand up and say, you know, let's take a hard look at what the left is claiming is going on here. And when you dig into their background, there are some pretty serious offenses against women going back all the way to the women's suffrage movement.
Well, what was it, Julia Remember Julia?
Yes, absolutely.
Does she make an appearance in the book?
She makes a big appearance in the book. For your listeners, as a refresher, during the 2012 campaign, Barack Obama put out this Life of Julia slideshow, which portrayed this young woman who was born and died, basically all, you know, and living her entire life getting a government handout. The government is there for her, whether she needs health care, food stamps, student loans, housing, to raise her child on her own without a father. And, you know, you sure hear a lot from the left about complaints about sexism, but my question is, why did the left not feel like it was necessary to put out a Life of John? If Democrats really think that women are strong and independent, why was it that they chose women to be the weaker of the sex and unable to function without the government holding their hand throughout their
that
entire life?
That is such a good point. And they've done.
True. I mean,
yes,
I.
You know
sexism.
What? It ticks me off that I didn't think of it. That's how. That's how good it is. I. You know, and it shows how we're all affected, except for Katie Pavlich, which is why you got to read her book. But if there, that's such a great point. Why shouldn't there be a Life of John?
Right.
We will take care of you, men, from birth to death.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Because it would have been regarded as offensive to men.
Right. Well, it should be. I mean, I think the pajama boy model is pretty offensive. And I guess
yeah.
You could say it might be the version of the Life of Julia. But, you know, it wasn't used in the 2012 campaign as the Life of Julia was. It's just, this book is about two things. It's about hypocrisy from the left on their claims of, you know, this war on women, but also calling them out for their own statements. You know, during the 2012 campaign, it was totally okay to go back to Mitt Romney's years in high school, what, in the 1950s, and talk about how he was a bully at school once, as most teenage boys do once in a lifetime. But it was completely inappropriate and taboo to talk about the fact that Ted Kennedy left a woman to die in his car, but yet he was upheld at the DNC convention in 2012, which I went to, as a women's rights champion at a convention where they were claiming to fight the war on women. I mean, their statements just aren't adding up on this issue.
All right, hold on there. I want to tell everybody again, it's Assault and Flattery. The book is up at my website. Katie Pavlich, who writes as clearly as she speaks. And we'll continue. If you listening have examples of where you feel that the left is bad for women, I'd like to hear from you. Hello, everybody. Dennis Prager here. Katie Pavlich, my guest, New York Times bestselling author of the book Assault and Flattery. It's so right. It's really, really good title, because that's what it is. The truth about the left and their war on women. Now, of course, anybody on the left, Katie, will respond, give me a break. We're the ones who fought for every aspect of women's equality. How would you answer that?
I would say, actually, if we want to take a real look at history, it was Democrats who voted against the women's suffrage movement. It was Republicans who voted for women's suffrage. And it wasn't until later, or much later in the 1960s, when Democrats finally came around and thought that women would be great politically to use for political reasons, did they change their mind and embrace a completely different kind of women's liberation movement, which, when you do your research, you know, I went to the National Organization for Women conference last summer to do some research for the book. And the material that I found there in terms of what they were selling at their booths were things like the Communist Manifesto by Karl Marx and Education for Socialists. And so, you know, in the 1960s, the left hijacked the women's rights movement, the fight for equality, and really used that as a disguise for not necessarily fighting for women's rights, but for implementing a new kind of economic system in this country, which we've seen play out through their promotion of women being dependent on their government and through their packaging of victimization over the past 50 years as empowerment for women.
How do you, as a woman, react to the charges that, for example, Harvard and Stanford and other places have a culture of rape on their campuses?
Well, I would first respond by saying, well, maybe when you don't allow women to defend themselves, you don't allow them to maybe carry a concealed weapon on campus, of course there would be more opportunity for violent predators to attack women. But in terms of this rape culture idea, I think that they approach it in a way that is not productive. They simply want to complain about it in order to get attention rather than offering real solutions. You know, in the book, I actually interviewed a young woman named Amanda Collins, who in 2005 attended the University of Nevada, Reno, and she was a victim of rape, and she walked to her car after a final late at night. She had a concealed weapons permit on her that night, but not her concealed weapon, and she was raped at gunpoint 50 feet away from the campus police station by a man who then went on to rape other women and killed another. And so there obviously is a problem with rape on campus, but it's not because men are evil or violent in general. It's because they set these zones up so that women are vulnerable to attacks.
When you speak of flattery in your title, what do you mean? What are they, in the sense that they keep telling women how terrific they are, but that mm-hmm. they need the Democrats? I mean, if they're so terrific, why do they need Democrats?
Right. Well, one of the definitions of flattery anyway is giving false compliments and insincere praise to meet a personal goal. And that's exactly how Democrats treat women. You know, Democrats talk about women in one way and treat them in a very, very different way. They speak about women in ways that are complimentary, but yet at the same time they treat them as if they're too stupid or not competent enough to get by on a daily basis without the government holding their hand. You know, it's amazing to me how the left claims that women don't need a man, and yet they're perfectly okay with women depending on a government that is run by men, by the way, to provide them with various...
Well, they would say we want it run by women. They would be happy to have the government run by women. So, but part one of what you said is our argument. Oh, so you don't need men, but you need the government? That's more ennobling? That's more
right.
Elevating? By the way, on this need men, it's a very interesting thing. It's a micro subject that I have dealt with on occasion on this program. And that is, men, it's such a reverse of reality. Men are totally at peace. The strongest men I know are at total peace. I am one of them in saying men need women.
Mm-hmm.
But it is considered a form of weakness, of betrayal of one's gender, to say that women need men.
What I think is first of all wrong. I mean, I think that women are capable of being independent on their own.
Well, so are men.
So are men. But it makes things, you know, life can be a little bit easier, especially as a woman with a child, if you have a man there to support you and to be accountable. And on that issue, you know, the left has done a huge disservice to all of us, men and women included, by taking away expectations of respect from men towards women. The left has, over the past 50 years, has taken away expectations of men to do basic things like, I don't know, be responsible for their action towards women. The left has set men up so that they have no obligation at all to respect women, and I think that is a huge, huge disservice they have done that will be detrimental for years and years to come.
That's key. That is key. I mean, when
they take away responsibility from men for anything. That men have to be responsible now for now. They don't have to, and it's because the feminists allow them to get away with it.
Let me very quickly go to your previous bestseller, Fast and Furious, and the Obama administration and that scandal. Is that over?
It is not over. It is one of the many scandals we've seen in the Obama administration. We are currently in a court battle over executive privilege. So what that means is there's a bunch of documents that Barack Obama has said fall under executive privilege, and a judge is taking a look at whether that executive privilege stands. So we're waiting on that lawsuit to see how we can move forward. Judicial Watch, which is an incredible organization, which has been amazing at getting information that Congress isn't capable of getting, just got a hearing last week about Fast and Furious documents. And so we'll see what kind of information they can gather as well. So it's not over. It just hasn't been in the headlines as
well. And I commend
tied up in the legal system.
I commend that book as well, of course, as I did when it was published, to my listeners. Katie, thank you so much. Keep writing. Keep speaking.
Thanks, Dennis. Really appreciate it.
You're very welcome. The book again, Assault and Flattery, The Truth About the Left and Their War on Women. It is up at DennisPrager.com. Take some calls. Got a lot more thoughts and two more hours together on The Dennis Prager Show. Hi, everybody. Welcome back. It's a pleasure to have at the microphone. I'm in Louisiana. And, Professor, are you in Massachusetts or Florida?
I am, and my son is in New Orleans, Louisiana, making a movie.
Wow, we were practically...
We're covering the world.
We are indeed. This is Professor Alan Dershowitz, one of the few people who you can say doesn't need an introduction, but in any event, I will. Professor of law at Harvard University and international lecturer, writer of many, many books, and now the featured lecturer in the latest Prager University course, and it is about the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement known as BDS that is in the Western world directed against one country, that major malefactor, Israel. And ironically, we didn't know it when you made the video, but look at what is happening right now. Are you disturbed by the way this war between Hamas and Israel is reported?
Absolutely. And the great villain is the New York Times. The New York Times uses words and language that convey constant state of moral equivalence. They talk about Hamas firing rockets in retaliation for this, that, or the other thing. They constantly show photographs of grieving Palestinians without explaining. They do this immoral death count as if to almost suggest that Israel's not living up to its responsibility by not allowing more of Israeli civilians to die. If only, you know, a rocket would hit some school buses and some hospitals, then maybe there'd be a moral equivalence, without in any way mentioning that Israel spends hundreds of millions of dollars protecting its civilians, whereas Hamas has a policy of not allowing its civilians into the tunnels or shelters and just using these safe places to safeguard the lives of its fighters and combatants. You know, when the Goldstone Report came out several years ago and talked about there were a lot of civilian casualties, people in Hamas started to complain. People in Gaza started to complain. They started to say, how come there's so many civilian casualties and there are so few Hamas fighters that are killed? Is it because the Hamas fighters hide, whereas they expose the Hamas civilians to this kind of counterattack? So I think the word's beginning to get out in Hamas, but not in the New York Times. The New York Times has been absolutely outrageous in its reporting. And, you know, I'm a guy who used to write a lot for the New York Times and still writes occasionally for them. They won't accept my op-eds on Israel. They'll let me write on any subject other than Israel. But as you know, they had, I think, 51 out of 53 in a row op-eds anti-Israel. Finally, they asked Netanyahu to submit an op-ed as a kind of whitewash cover, and to his credit, Bibi said, no way, I'm not giving you cover. You've written all these anti-Israel op-eds, now you expect me to give you cover? No way. And he sent it into the Wall Street Journal instead.
Yeah, I do recall that. All right, so I'll ask you, because you and I have dialogued and quote-unquote debated on a number of occasions on both coasts. So this moral equivalence is coming from your side.
What do you mean, my side?
Which is, by the way,
the pro-Israel side.
I'm sorry?
What do you mean, my side?
I understand.
My side.
All right, well, your side. Look, you know, you are a bona fide liberal, and I say that only with respect.
Right.
So I this is not a challenge. It's really just a curiosity. What has happened to your side?
Well,
this is a big deal.
It's first of all, it started with the radical left. It happened, you know, there are many villains of this piece. Noam Chomsky, obviously one of them, Father Berrigan another. But, you know, in the 1970s, the Soviet Union really decided, earlier than that, but really full-fledged decided that Israel was the enemy of communism and of socialism and of the hard left. And it essentially sent instructions to its minions, the European Communist parties, other leftist parties, to turn against Israel. And people like Berrigan, who essentially were puppets of the hard left, and Chomsky, who was a puppet of the hard left, began to use Israel as the paradigm, the litmus test for, are you really left? If you're really left, you have to oppose Israel and support anything the Palestinians do, whether it be Hamas, Hezbollah, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, anything. And that seeped into academia, and it seeped into the media. Not true of all the media, The Washington Post has been generally pro-Israel. The Boston Globe has had a decent policy toward Israel. It's the New York Times. And it's not only the New York Times editorial page, it's their news reporting, which is completely and totally one-sided and biased.
All right, I want to hear more about that, and I remind everybody, the latest Prager University video is given by Harvard Law Professor Dershowitz, and it is on the attempt to strangle Israel with the boycott, divest, sanctions movement. What you learn is priceless, there is true, and so it is at the latest course given by Harvard Law Professor Alan Dershowitz. Its title is BDS, The Attempt to Strangle Israel. BDS is Boycott, Divest, and Sanctions. And it is a movement that is popular on parts of the left in the academic world in particular. And Professor Dershowitz, who is a renowned liberal, to his great credit, has been opposed to this, and this video is extremely powerful. And by the way, congratulations to you on it, because it's
well, thank you. I appreciate it.
In my
new book, I just wrote a new autobiography called Taking the Stand, My Life and the Law. I have a whole chapter explaining how the left, the hard left, turned against Israel, and why I decided to devote so much of my time politically and media-wise to fighting within the left. And in it, I also urge people on the right to oppose the Pat Buchanans and the anti-Israeli and anti-Semitic people on the right. I think those of us on the left have an obligation to fight harder against the Chomskys, the Finkelsteins, the Gilad Atzmons, and the New York Times. And those on the right have an obligation to make sure that their side remains principled when it comes to the Middle East discussion.
Yeah, I agree with you, but I don't think there's a symmetry. I mean, the numbers on the right who are anti-Israel and their influence, and even their obsession, is not comparable to the amount and the names that you've listed on the left.
No, I agree with you.
Pat Buchanan does not devote his time to knocking Israel.
You know, it used to be the opposite half a century ago when it was the hard right.
Yes.
That was very anti-Israel,
right.
The oil interests,
okay.
The State Department.
Right.
Today that's changed, and that's a tragedy. But, you know, it's very important that support for Israel remain a bipartisan issue, and that never happens in America what's happened in Spain, for example, where when the conservatives win, it's pro-Israel. When the socialists win, it's anti-Israel. England, a little less so. France, to some degree. But in many countries, elections are. Norway recently was a real referendum on Israel, and you know the conservatives won, and now the government is more pro-Israel. That can never be allowed to happen in the United States. The issue has to remain bipartisan, which is why people like me have to keep working within the Democratic Party, within the left, within the New York Times, to try to get changes in policy.
It's afflicted the left in the churches, too. I know you know about the Presbyterian Church USA and its vote to have sanctions against Israel.
And there's an interesting thing going on. There's a town somewhere where they're trying to build a Presbyterian church, and there's opposition to it among pro-Israel people saying, this isn't a church, this is a political organization. Why do we need to give tax exemption to a group that's devoting itself to boycotting one single country in the world, putting all the blame on one country in the world? And there's a real effort to try to make the Presbyterian Church pay a heavy price so that the good people within the Presbyterian Church will turn against the radical leaders that have articulated this anti-Israel BDS approval. And by the way, the Presbyterians are not the only church. The Quakers, of course, have been against Israel since as long as I can remember, back in the late 1960s, even before the occupation. The Quaker Church was virulently anti-Israel, claiming moral equivalence, but if you look at their documents, they were very anti-Israel. You know, to its credit, the Catholic Church has changed dramatically. And, you know, the Pope refused to visit Israel. The Vatican didn't recognize Israel until very late in history, but now I think it's become a far fairer and obviously much more important instrument of some degree of balance.
Well, you've done a great job. I just want to tell you the video is already it'll hit, I'm sure, 500,000 in its time. And it's
great.
I thank you for making it. Joseph Telushkin, whom I know you respect tremendously, actually called Alan Estrin and told him how terrific you were. So
that's great. You know, and everybody should read Joe Telushkin's new book. He just wrote a new book on the Lubavitcher rabbi called Rebbe. It's a remarkable book. No matter what religion or not religion you're a part of, Joe Telushkin's book is so informative and so brilliant about a charismatic and important leader. It should be read by everybody.
Well, both you and I have blurbs on the back of the book, so
you know
I agree. Alan Dershowitz, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. And again, his is the latest video up at Prager University. I will tell you that I just found out today that some major Israeli, the Israel Video Network said that this is the one that I made on the Middle East, which we released a few weeks ago, is the most important video about Israel ever made. And so this annoyed the most prestigious newspaper in Israel, Haaretz, who wrote an entire piece against my video. And I'm delighted. I'm just delighted. It means that, look, it's almost 2 million views on that, and that's the second incarnation of that video. And it's amazing because Haaretz is, of course, the most left-wing of Israel's major newspapers, and so they don't like the idea that somebody would explain the Middle East conflict as essentially one side wants the other one dead. But that's exactly what we're seeing with Hamas. They've declared it. But for the left, even in Israel, that is too problematic. Israel must be the problem and not the people who wish to extinguish it. It's a backwards world, and so often it's called the Middle East problem. And that too is at Prager University. I have a great question to pose for you when we come back. Why did Time magazine say that the United States is 11th in health care in the world? I have an answer for you, and it is very helpful in understanding how you get the news that you get and how people are influenced. Back in a moment. I'm Dennis Prager. Hi, everybody. Dennis Prager here. Big thanks to Gino sitting in for Sean. Wishing Sean well. Little health issue, and he'll be fine, I know, but I just want to wish it to him anyway. And I guess I should thank Comrex, because they've made a box here that makes broadcasting from anywhere in the world flawless. second day in a row broadcasting from Louisiana. There's a piece in Time magazine this week, and it's actually one column, data. It's under the thing, under the heading of data, global healthcare. And it shows a heart with the pulse sign in the middle. Number 1, UK, number 3, Sweden, number 5, Germany, number 9, France, number 11, US. People will look at that. Maybe they'll read what's written or not. It's only one sentence, two sentences anyway. So how did they get this ranking that we're 11th? So listen to it. Listen to this. This is the entire description of the ranking. The Commonwealth Fund ranked healthcare systems in 11 wealthy nations according to criteria such as quality and access. Below, a sampling of the rankings. And then, as I told you, UK 1, Sweden 3, and so on. US 11. And that's it. One out of 400,000 readers will know what the Commonwealth Fund is. Time magazine doesn't identify the Commonwealth Fund. I do in my book, Still the Best Hope. That's how I know about it, because this is done so often. The Commonwealth Fund is a left-wing, one-payer advocate organization. They want to nationalize the American health system. Now, do you think that that would have been different had they reported the truth? The Commonwealth Fund, which is active in promoting nationalized health care, ranked the following health care systems in the world. This is how people believe what leftism teaches, because it's so dishonest and because it is so thorough in its blanketing. Would they do that with a right-wing organization? Of course not. They would never take its ranking to begin with, and if they ever did, they would say, an organization that believes in independent paying, people individually paying for their health care. Just thought you ought to know. Time Magazine and its rankings and the way they're described. I can spend all day, every day, showing you the same thing. And in effect, I do. See you tomorrow from L.A. I'm Dennis Prager. Thanks. Hi, everybody, and welcome back. Dennis Prager here in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Had a wonderful dialogue with the governor last hour. Again, Pragertopia.com is the way for you to hear any of the hours at any time you want. And I have, as a guest now on the line from New York City, Adam Bello. Adam Bello. Adam Bello is executive editor at HarperCollins, and in terms of full disclosure, he is my editor, and he is a wonderful and intelligent, highly intelligent thinker about American life, but he's not on because he's my editor. If he were, I would have had him on a long time ago. He's on because he is starting a very interesting project that should interest people who care about our culture. So, Adam Bello, welcome to my show.
Thank you, Dennis. It's a pleasure to be here.
So you wrote this long piece for National Review and elsewhere, and so tell us what you're working on.
Well, as you know, as you graciously acknowledged, I'm your editor, and I also have been an editor of other conservative intellectuals and journalists, political figures, for nearly 30 years. I have been a nonfiction editor in this business, but in the last couple of years, it began to come to my attention that many conservatives had turned to the writing of fiction. I learned this first from some of my own authors who approached me to let me know that they had written novels and to ask if HarperCollins would consider publishing them. And I had to explain to them that that the commercial publishing industry doesn't really recognize conservative fiction as an existing genre or market. And so I explained to them that they would really have to go and publish their own books, which people can now do very effectively. But, of course, it turned out that although you can publish your own novel, getting people to hear about it and to read it is another matter. So I decided to create a place online, a magazine, which I call Liberty Island, where conservative readers and writers can come together to find the best of this new and very exciting development. It's, in fact, a new publishing category, a new genre of fiction, and it is an explosion of creativity. And so I decided to write an article for the National Review announcing the emergence of this new literary wing of the culture war, and to call for conservatives to come and to check it out and to give these writers their support, because they're struggling to find an audience, and many of them are very, very talented.
I'm looking at it right now. It's called Liberty Island, Let Your Right Brain Run Free. It's a cute motto. So now let me understand. This is, what does conservative fiction mean? It means fiction with conservative values as opposed to the regular ones that dominate fiction?
Well, as you know, all conservatives who are paying attention are aware, I think, that the popular culture in general is dominated by liberals. That doesn't mean that every book you read or every TV show or movie that you watch advances a political line, but it does reflect a worldview and a set of values and a sensibility. And the liberalism of popular culture, which we as conservatives are very aware of, is invisible to liberals themselves. It's like, you know, fish swimming in the water that they don't even realize they're swimming in it. Now, what is conservative about conservative fiction? Well, you know, that's a really good question. It's not really one that I feel that I can answer simply or easily. I do think, in part because I think it's sort of up to the, it's going to be up to writers themselves to figure that out. But I can say this. Conservative fiction could be anything. Ranging from the works of someone like Tom Clancy, who writes thrillers in which there are no politics discussed, but the hero of Clancy's novels is somebody who embodies American values and virtues, and this is somebody who we sort of admire and sympathize with. And it can include somebody like Tom Wolfe, who is a very keen social observer, who writes social novels that comment on the manners and mores of the liberal governing or a social elite, and it could be the work of somebody like Mark Helprin,
right. But of course, these three we've had Mark on. These three are published.
Yes.
So they wouldn't need you, as it were.
No, that's correct. And if Liberty Island weren't needed, I wouldn't have created it.
Exactly. Let me ask you, who determines what goes up on Liberty Island?
Well,
I assume you just can't put something up.
Well, actually, you can. What we have done is we've created a kind of a two-tier approach. The homepage, which is our magazine, is where we publish work that we like, that we've personally selected, that fits our editorial parameters, that we have edited and worked on, and that we are featuring, and we're presenting that as the stuff that we have chosen that we like. We also have what we call an open range section, where anybody who wants to can post and publish their own work. Now, we monitor that section, and we read everything that's posted there, and if it doesn't fit into our parameters, either because it's has no political or cultural point of view at all, or because it just doesn't fit with what we're doing, or it doesn't meet our standards of quality, or it's in some way, you know, socially offensive, we take it down. But for the most part, what we want is to permit a kind of bottom-up process so that readers themselves can decide what they like the most. So anything published on the open range can be read and reviewed and rated by readers, and if enough people like it, we may decide
All right.
to feature it on our own page.
When we return after this break, I want you to tell me what you would like people to do, because I think this is important enough to have featured on my show. Fiction with conservative values. Hallelujah. Back in a moment. Hello, everybody, from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Dennis Prager, Adam Bello in New York City, executive editor at HarperCollins. He has started something important. He is trying to encourage and publish conservative fiction. The world of fiction, like much of the worlds of any of the arts, have been dominated by folks on the left. So what would you like people like my listeners to do?
Well, here's what I want them to know, and to understand. We're not just talking about a few writers here and there. We're talking about hundreds and thousands, in fact, of people who are writing and publishing their own fiction, and also, by the way, other kinds of creative expression, popular music, graphics, film, video, game design, all kinds of stuff that conservatives are now able to do and are doing on their own, and they are struggling to get to find an audience. What I'm arguing in the piece in National Review is that this phenomenon amounts in the aggregate to a new counterculture, and conservatives need to wake up and recognize the existence of this counterculture, and in my view, they need to support it. Liberty Island is one way in which conservatives and libertarians can support the new culture by coming to the site, signing up as members, joining our community, submitting their creative work, and if they're so inclined, contributing to our crowdfunding effort, which can be found at a website devoted to the support of publishing efforts. It's known as Pub Slush. And the link to the site is posted on your website. We're down to the final few days of our campaign, and we are trying to raise money so that we can launch our first line of commercially published novels, which will come out in the fall. We are opening a new front in the culture war, and we hope that conservatives will be moved to support us and to support the writers, because that's the most important thing.
All right, so folks, here's the thing. It's up now at DennisPrager.com. So we have the crowdfunding website, and we have Liberty Island website up at our website. And look, if you want to fight for a better America, this is an extremely important avenue. We're not suppressing anybody. We are simply adding another voice of traditional values. I like the word traditional. Not every tradition is great, but we have lived off the great fruits that the traditional trees have borne. So, Adam Bello, congratulations to you. Much success I wish you, and I wish my listeners to please go to our website and go and visit Liberty Island and the crowdfunding source.
Thanks.
Thank you, Adam.
Dennis.
You're very welcome. Ultimate Issues Hour coming up on my Day with Murderers yesterday.